In the last 6 weeks, ever since the first allegations against Harvey Weinstein of the sexual harassment and assault of dozens of women, we've seen the emergence of an endless array of new alleged perpetrators who use their power to intimidate or abuse the women or men in their midst. In a recent article titled Your Reckoning and Mine, New York Magazine writer Rebecca Traister explores how this moment shifts our understanding of our past and present and what may be in store. I spoke to her for this Friday's show, but decided to offer a version that's much longer, hardly edited at all, to you devoted podcast listeners. So here it is. Welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you wrote, "The anger window is open." How many emails have you been getting each day?
Well, it varies. It started really the day after the Harvey Weinstein story broke. I wrote a piece about how he had screamed at me as a young reporter and called me the C word and had kind of a violent and very loud altercation with me at an event 17 years earlier. That, and also because I write about feminism, made me a reporter who people wanted to reach out to on this subject. And so starting that night, I began to get anywhere between 5 to 20 emails a day.
Wow.
Mostly women, some men as well, telling me in various ways about this predation, harassment, assault, rape in some cases, that they had suffered. Some recently, some 40 years ago, some 5 years ago. Some women telling me about serial harassment, some women telling me about one particularly violent episode, expressing guilt over having not spoken up, many of them speaking to me still off the record or under fake addresses because they wanted to preserve their identities. That's only a few of them. Others wanting to speak on the record. Every day my inbox is full of people telling me really terrible, painful stories about what's happened to them at their workplace or with colleagues, with bosses. Things that have shaped their lives.
Is it because there was a chance that this stuff would actually be printed rather than just pushed aside? Is it because, as you wrote in your piece, they were seeing a matrix moment, the fact that they were part of a much bigger pattern?
I think it's two things. One is the media opportunity. Right? And that's the sort of cynical read on it, which is there's sudden interest in this because the first story, which is the Harvey Weinstein story, is a story of such outsized villainy. That's a story about serial rape. It is a story in which Harvey Weinstein now is reported to have gotten former Mossad agents to stalk and spy on people who might come out against him. The story that is so outsized in its malevolence and violence, you could not help but start looking at this stuff. And so from that lens, this has created an interest in this subject. And so yes, to some degree, it's that people are willing to take their calls, reporters are interested, newspapers are willing to print this stuff on the front pages. The second thing is, I think, the matrix moment, that now that the flood has started, there are reports about well-known people every day, it seems. There are days when three people will be in the newspapers, three men with allegations of harassment or assault. We're seeing how common it is in the elite professions amongst the powerful and the famous. But we also, as we're reacting to these stories, are talking to our friends and our colleagues. There's a social media campaign that says Me Too. And so we're understanding the ubiquity. I say in my piece, it's like the house lights have come up and we're seeing the scaffolding on which so many of our professional lives have been built.
Roger Ailes, the chief of Fox News, a powerful guy, his villainy, the employment of spies, the manipulation of the media, payoffs, threats, and behavior that goes far beyond words and glances and inappropriateness into downright illegality, that rivals Harvey Weinstein's villainy, almost. And yet the floodgates did not fly open at that point.
Right. So I think that there are two reasons why, working in concert with each other. First is an ideological and partisan reason. Roger Ailes controlled a massive arm of right-wing media in Fox News. So you had some significant portion of the country having the news of Ailes' villainy ignored or defended. right? So you take out a huge chunk of the population that's even believing that that's a true story because there's an ideological incentive to not believe it with regard to ales. So that's the first thing. When it comes to Weinstein, the right wing is all in because he's a Democratic donor. And so that portion of the country whose interest had been shifted away from a story about ales within the past couple years was very invested in repeating and amplifying the story about Weinstein. So you get that section of the country back. Then you look at the left. A lot of this is coming out of, I believe, post-election rage. You had an example of a moment like this in the weeks before the 2016 election, when Donald Trump is caught on tape on Access Hollywood bragging about grabbing women against their will. And at the same time, more than 20 women accuse him of unwanted sexual assault, really gross charges. There were social media campaigns, there was outrage, there was fury on the left. Of course, again, that fury didn't translate to a right-wing media, which was protecting its presidential candidate and writing this off as just how men behave. But on the left, it felt like, okay, this is a transformative moment. We're seeing what Donald Trump did, and we're also having a conversation about how pervasive it is, and we have the tools at our disposal to get this man to not have a job. We can vote in the election. But of course, it didn't work. And I think that the fact that a lid was put on the rage that was brewing then, a year ago, made the left wing part of this just ready to explode. After years of having their own stories and their own experiences, just not even noticed, not cared about if they complained about them, you know, getting punished. There's all that built up rage. And then the election of Donald Trump is sort of the distillation of that. The predator, the confessed predator,
yeah,
gets the biggest job despite the confession, despite the word of 20 women who say that he kissed them against their will. He still got the biggest job. That works as a metaphor for so many women's professional experience of having worked with harassers or gropers or men who assaulted them and watching those men succeed while women's fortunes are diminished by having to spend so much energy navigating around that kind of behavior. And I think the Trump election served as a metaphor that made the left just ready to explode on that front.
The biggest job, not necessarily the worst behavior, just behavior that is utterly unacceptable. Trying to put things on a spectrum has created a lot of confusion. You wrote about someone who'd written to you, a guy who'd asked a woman who'd auditioned for a show he was casting, and after she didn't get the part, he invited her to go to a puppet show. He asked you, was that bad? And you said, I don't know. Well, isn't this issue of, you know, if you give somebody a salacious look in an elevator, are you going to be put on the same list as Harvey Weinstein? For instance, a young Dustin Hoffman saying sexual comments to a woman on a movie set and then getting soundly rebuffed. You know, no real consequences for either of them.
Right, but let me say something about that Dustin Hoffman story. We also have to acknowledge there's a way in which when we worry about the compression of those distinctions, right, the blurring of the lines, and we have this conversation where we say, oh my God, what if every guy who ever had an awkward work lunch winds up losing his job? And I feel compelled to point out that these guys have not been losing their jobs,
right?
So that some of the lesser reports, yes, there have been embarrassing reports. The Dustin Hoffman story is a story that doesn't make him look good, but it's not like he's suffering undue consequences. And that story, by the way, I found that story. No, it's not rape. Nobody's suggesting that it's rape. Her story is itself incredibly nuanced about the affection she felt for him, her desire to play along, to not be the young girl who objects. It was a really beautifully told story about the conflicting emotions that many of us have when we're caught in these interactions. It's not black and white, like kill the witch,
right?
Which is how those who are defending against this treat it, as though, oh no, the next guy who tries to ask a woman up is going to be thrown in the stocks. There has not been an example that I can think of so far, and it could happen any day now, but so far there has not been an example of somebody who has been grossly punished for something that seems like a totally minor infraction.
Gay Talese said that Anthony Rapp, talking about being a 14-year-old assaulted by Kevin Spacey, said Gay Talese in a particularly in Felicitous phrase, I think, he should just suck it up.
Mike Barnicle, the journalist, who is a regular on Morning Joe, where Mark Halperin, who has lost his perch on Morning Joe, but he was also a regular. They were colleagues, political journalists. And Mark Halperin, who was accused by multiple women while they were subordinate employees and while he had professional power over them, young, ambitious women in the news business, he, against their will, pressed his penis against them in the office. I mean, this is a really bad, this is not a gray area, what Mark Halperin has been accused of and to some extent has admitted to, that happened on multiple occasions to women he had power over. And he very appropriately, I feel, lost some jobs. He lost his deal with HBO. He lost his perch on Morning Joe. And Mike Barnicle, who is his colleague and I gather his friend, sort of bemoaned this and said, sure, what he did was bad. And of course he should face consequences. And then he said, but does he have to be killed? How many times does he have to die? And I read that and I was like, he hasn't died.
Exactly.
No one sentenced him to death.
And you and many others have made the point that he's lost his job, just as Kevin Spacey has lost his job and Louis C.K. But we need to weigh loss against loss, which is hard because it's very difficult to measure the opportunity cost of so many women denied raises, denied employment, or just generally discouraged right out of the business because of these often traumatizing events.
Right. And it's the difference between trying to wrap our heads around mass harm, systemic disadvantage, which is what these women feel. Some of these women don't identify themselves or they left the business. We don't know who they are. It's also just trying to conceive of it as something that happens across industries to all kinds of women whose names we don't know, who aren't beloved actors, who aren't in our favorite movies, who aren't on our television sets every morning the way the individual accused men are, right? And so it's very easy for us to immediately feel, for example, the way that Gay Talese talks about, oh, poor Kevin Spacey and this great actor, his career brought down. Kevin Spacey has now also been multiply accused of molesting young boys against their will, of serial assault against underage boys. Imagine the harm done to them. The difference is Anthony Rapp is an exception because people do know who he is. Lots of the people who Spacey is accused of having hurt are guys we don't know. They've never played our favorite role in our favorite movie. So it's harder for us to get to the point where we think, oh, poor nameless men who were damaged.
Right.
And in the case of the women, Mark Halperin, who are these women? We don't know who they are. They didn't write Game Change. They're not on Morning Joe every morning.
Right.
So we can imagine, oh, this is Mark Halperin, whose face I know and whose voice I know. And I feel sorry about what's going to happen to him because he exists in our imagination in part because he's had a powerful career. He has ascended within his business. That's part of the point. Men are more likely to be the big figures who are familiar to us, to have the voices that are recognizable to us, and to have a claim on our affection and our sympathy. And I don't think it's wrong. I want to be really clear. I do not think there's anything wrong with considering the fates of these guys and feeling sympathy for them. We are human beings. We understand failure, weakness, and crime. We understand that it is okay to have human emotions and anxiety about hurting the people, even who deserve to lose their jobs, even who deserve probably criminal prosecution in a couple of these cases, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't reflexively engage those same sympathetic impulses toward the women whose careers, who were never allowed to become the faces on your television and movie screens. We don't know who they are, but their families have been damaged too. Their wages lowered, in many cases driven out of the profession. There's a researcher who has said that 50% of women who face harassment change jobs within 2 years of that harassment. And if the harassment is particularly bad, that's 80%. That means we always wonder about wage gaps and why aren't there women in these professions? Many of them are driven out by these kind of pervasive, ubiquitous circumstances. And we don't spare a lot of our sympathy worrying about the kind of economic, social, and professional impact that that's had on those women.
Let me ask you a question, something that I've been slammed with, and I just want to know how you feel. Journalist Matt Taibbi wrote a great book about Eric Garner, an unarmed man who was killed by New York police. Back in the 90s, he wrote some deeply offensive, sexist crap. And mm-hmm. he even co-wrote a book in which his writing partner told stories of sexual predation in Russia in the 90s. Now, Taibbi told us, and he's written, that he deeply regrets the stuff he wrote and says that none of what his co-writer wrote ever happened. There was a woman who stepped forward on Twitter who'd worked with them back in that office in Russia then, and she said, Taibbi's right, none of it ever happened. She was buried under criticism, and he is repeatedly labeled a serial rapist. And so I ask you, is it helpful to condemn him before any actual person has charged him? And is it fair?
Based on what I know so far, I wouldn't argue that Taibbi was a rapist. Right? That's never been my view. I don't know. I have no idea what happened in Russia. I know what he wrote, which was misogynistic crap. I find some of his retroactive explanations of it to be problematic in their own ways. Like, oh, it was just my writing. It was just Mark Ames who did this, my writing partner. I never wrote any of that problematic stuff. That's absolutely not the case. I mean, and he does say he wrote misogynistic stuff. Some of the stuff he wrote about Russian women versus American feminists and is just... The act of predation, I have no idea. I don't know. And that's never been my beef with Taibbi, though certainly the accounts of it, if they were true,
would be
are
criminal.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
Right. But that has not been my beef with Taibbi. What I write at this moment, as I look at him sort of being forced by this conversation to reassess the stuff that he wrote and published, and by the way, defended until very recently, this story now,
his
deep sorrow and his regret, and he's so embarrassed about that book. It was just a few years ago that another journalist doing an interview with him, I believe Vanity Fair, I think it's a journalist named James Verini, told him that he didn't like that book, The Exile, in which there was all that misogynistic stuff, and Taibbi became so enraged that he threw a cup of coffee in his face.
Jeez.
Defending that book. And that was, I believe, in 2010. Mm. So it's not as though he's been regretting and distancing himself from that material for
ever
so long.
Since, yeah.
But my beef with him is very specific, because what is true is that whether or not it was satire, and by the way, the whole move to say, oh, it was all just a joke, that is also kind of metaphorically connected to something that women get told all the time, like,
right.
Oh, have a sense of humor. But the other part of it is, it's how he made his name. He promoted that book. He did contemporaneous interviews in which he, whether he was playing a part or whether it was authentic, I almost don't care for the purposes of this particular critique. He was out dealing in misogyny to sell his book, to make money, to make his name. And it worked. It's how he made his reputation. This is about a kind of gender inequity in the profession that both Taibbi and I work in. There is a room for a certain kind of male character, a retro macho sexist guy who can be viewed as kind of edgy and cool. And that was the character, whether it was authentic or satirical, that Taibbi made his name on. And his writing about women wasn't just 17 years ago in Russia. He wrote a piece for a magazine in 2009, I think, in which he wrote incredibly sexist things about women and sports wives and smoking hot skanks. It's not as though the misogyny of his early writings is walled off back 17 years ago. And the issue with him particularly is that he is a progressive writer. He's somebody who ideologically is supposed to stand and who would tell you that he does stand for progressive values, including equality of opportunity and possibility across races, classes, and genders. And yet, the fact that he has profited from and promoted really sexist crap under his own name doesn't seem to complicate the degree to which he wants us to respect him as a progressive voice.
Do you think I shouldn't have had him on to talk about Eric Garner?
No. If I were the judge, I would say absolutely have him on to talk about Eric Garner. I haven't read the book. I hear it's very good. It's obviously a crucial subject. Have him on to talk about the good work that he's doing, but press him really hard on his own sexism, really hard. The point I make in my piece is he writes in his apology and explanation of his misogyny about how he's really wanted to write important books like this, like about Eric Garner for 30 years. That's terrific. And I'm glad he has written this important book. But there are so many women out there who would also like to write books about racial injustice, about economic inequality, about sexism itself and its systemic impact on women, but who don't have the opportunity in a profession that remains dominated by men who can still make their careers in part by dealing in misogyny. And to press him on how he's profited from this continually in a way that he can't just write off, and press him on how his perspectives on gender inequality and women play into his progressive politics. And so, sure, talk to people about the
but
work you're doing now.
Press him much harder than I did. I raised
press
the question and
really
dropped
it. Hard.
I didn't want to distract from the Garner discussion. I felt like it would just completely get hijacked. But
right,
I hear what you're saying.
But I guess I see that if you're committed to exposing the kind of injustice that led to Eric Garner's death, but you yourself have been actively complicit in other kinds of systemic suppression of opportunity, if part of your work has been built on and profited from the denigration of women, then you are part of the story and part of the system of injustice that you're seeking to expose in your progressive journalism. That's my view. And I think that the Taibbi story and the questions about it are a real reflection of how we as progressives, and here we're talking not so much about media people, but people on the left, the first thing that can be sacrificed is a discussion of serious systemic gender inequity. And that doesn't take away from your identity as a progressive. And I don't think we'd feel that way if, for example, Matt Taibbi had written in support of big banks, right? Wouldn't that make his progressive stature problematic?
It's so much like the wallpaper of our lives, the attitudes towards women, that sometimes it's hard to focus on it because it's so big.
Right. It's half the population is women. And the left is very implicated. I mean, just as the left is also implicated in racism and sexism. I mean, it's a real problem. And it's a conversation that feminists have been having for a long time, trying to point out, look, sexism exists on the left. And in fact, in some ways, sexism feels more pernicious on the left because it's coming from people who are claiming to be ideologically supportive of women, and yet you can see the reflection in terms of policy choices that we're willing to trade in healthcare reform. And this is only a few years ago, really, that the first thing we're willing to trade on is abortion.
Which brings us to another point that you made. You say that focusing, for instance, on the ever-lengthening list of bad actors can distract us from the bigger issues and, in fact, distorts our view of what's really going on.
Right. On the one hand, it's very easy to understand how individual stories of individual bad actors wind up making it into the news. First of all, there are narratives that we can follow very easily. There are allegations that are very specific about very specific kinds of people. And so,
and
that's
know
important.
These people.
When they're very powerful, they're often familiar to us as celebrities. So if you hook somebody because the story is about a famous person who they either like or hate, then they're going to read and experience the horror and understand something new about what this experience might have been like for the person who's making the accusations. However, in the process of making so much of the reporting about these individual cases, we lose perspective on how this is, in fact, a structural reality, how many workplaces it exists in. And we know that from our social lives, right? From friends and colleagues and from men often these days saying, I had no idea, but now every one of my female friends, my wife, my daughter, my sister, they're all telling me that this has happened to them, some form of it, some form of harassment or in many cases assault. There is now a conversational personal acknowledgement of how pervasive and ubiquitous this is.
That's the Matrix moment.
It's the Matrix moment. It's realizing how it's all around us.
When you're seeing the Matrix moment, that you're working inside of the system, even though the attention is shifted to the abusers, it's often the victims who are doing the soul searching. And they're asking, am I complicit? Was I working the system? You have to live within the system. How did that shape my own behavior? And what do you make of that reckoning?
Well, that is exactly one of the costs. It's one of the additional tolls that is paid by the people who have less power in the situation, who have been the object of harassment or who have not had the power to stop it or who now are wondering, did I have the power to stop it? It is true. I think this is a moment unlike any other where some of the bad actors themselves are doing some of the accounting, but a huge amount of painful reckoning is being done by women who are wondering what their roles were, wondering to what degree they profited or lost professionally from their participation in this kind of behavior or their refusal to participate in it. And that is, it's, I find it very sad that it is still, to some degree, so much about women. There's actually, I didn't quote this particular thing in my piece, but one of the women that I spoke to said to me exactly this. She said, I'm so mad because it's still women having these conversations. And she said, and sure, sometimes women are having them with men, but these are men who should be having these conversations. This mm-hmm. is men who should be up all night, you know, having these memories and not being scared just for their own hides, not being scared. I'm adding this now. This is not what she said. I'm adding this to her sentiment because I do think there are a lot of men who are scared. A lot of them have spoken to me. Oh no, what if I did something? And there's this fear that there's going to be retribution, that they're going to be asked to pay for it. And that's good. I think it's important that men are sort of coming to terms with this. But it is also true that they're, in many cases, worried about their own fate. And I don't yet know how many of those men are also thinking, oh my God, what damage did I do? Who did I hurt? That's not part of the conversation that I've heard at great volume yet. There's a kind of like, oh my God, I was a part of this or I profited from it. But I don't yet think that there's a huge amount of consideration for what happened to the woman that I did this to. What became of her? Did I fundamentally alter the circumstances of her life, of her work, of her economic stability, her social or emotional stability? I haven't yet heard a lot of that.
You write about a generational divide in response to all of these revelations. What do they say about what we've been conditioned to accept as normal?
So in terms of the generational divide, on the one side are older women who came of age in the years before Anita Hill's groundbreaking 1991 testimony against Clarence Thomas, in which she accused Thomas, who was then nominated for the Supreme Court, of having sexually harassed her when they worked together. He obviously got confirmed for the court anyway, but her testimony was a real shift in an American understanding of what sexual harassment was, and that it wasn't just some quirky male-female behavior and just how guys were in the office, but that it was actually, it was a behavior that did material damage to women as a class.
And you have quoted the sociology professor Heather McLaughlin at Oklahoma State, who found that about half of women in their late 20s who experienced harassment started looking for a new job within 2 years. And for those who endured more serious harassment, the figure's around 80%, and many opt to leave their profession altogether and to start over in less male-dominated fields where the pay is lower. All that stuff, I don't know whether that relates to women post Anita Hill or pre Anita Hill?
Well, I think her study is of women post Anita Hill, but I do think that I think the difference pre and post Anita Hill that have been observable to me, anecdotally certainly, and as a reporter, is that women raised in an era before sexual harassment was identified as something that did damage to women and was in mm-hmm. fact on some level criminal, is that women raised before that moment were just expected this to be the way that men behave toward them in the office. And in fact, some of them, and you can hear it, I can hear it in conversations I have with some older women, sort of pride themselves on having gotten through it themselves. And oh, come on, toughen up. And I don't mean to say this critically. I think it is the way that generations of women were raised. Okay, you can go into the workforce, but you should know they're going to grab you, they're going to harass you, and you have a series of choices in how you want to deal with it. You can either not deal with it by not being in the workforce, or you can tough it out, or you can respond, or you can profit from it. But then post Anita Hill, there's this assessment that in fact this behavior is wrong and that it shouldn't happen. It's unprofessional to criminal. And women raised with those attitudes, thinking my opportunities are not supposed to be determined just by men and certainly not by their sexualized behavior toward me. Those women are, I think, more likely to say this is not okay.
So that suggests that this wave we're experiencing now could actually augur change? Or is it just part of an ebb and flow?
I think both things are simultaneously possible. I think this moment will fade. And I write in the piece about my fears about tremendous backlash and punishment for this moment. Mm-hmm. It has been so explosive, but we know, looking at the history of social change in this country, that when there is a huge leap, when it comes to talking and understanding, you know, gendered and racial disadvantage, you get slapped back. And I think that will happen in one form or another, and I'm very fearful about what form it will take. At the same time, these explosive moments, even if there is retribution that follows them, even if there is backsliding that follows them, they're part of the process of forward motion. And this one is going to be formative for a lot of people, for a lot of young women in the workforce who are listening to these stories, women who are about to enter a workforce. I think that you're going to see a generational shift that's going to play out over decades. And so I think both things are true. I think this moment is certainly, we're not going to live like this forever. There will be retribution and backlash, but I also think that we will look back on this moment as being formative in the long term.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Rebecca Traister is a writer at large at New York Magazine and The Cut. Her recent article is called Your Reckoning and Mine. The next hour of On the Media will be dedicated to a more thorough exploration of the themes touched on here, including considerations of how or whether to separate the artist from his art, looking back on the mostly forgiven predations of Bill Clinton, and ahead to the inevitable backlash to our current moment of reckoning. See you Friday.